Blog Talk Radio.
So the biggest business story of the last few weeks, other than the fact that the U.S. economy is not growing, but that's not really news. That's just a reality that's been going on for quite a while. The biggest business story is this fraud committed by Volkswagen, where they have basically, through software, cheated on emission standards, on nitrogen oxide. In the United States, and millions of diesel-based cars were giving false readings to the testers when they were tested on their emission standards. And of course, this has opened up a huge can of worms. Why are Europeans using diesel? Is diesel cleaner in any meaningful sense than fuel? To what extent are politicians responsible for what's going on at VW and responsible for the shift towards diesel? So we're going to be talking about all of that and much more. Lots of great topics today. We're also going to get a call in from this new CEO of a new student organization called Strive, and she is going to describe the upcoming conference that Strive is having, a conference for students interested in Ayn Rand's ideas, interested in applying those ideas in their own life, and that conference is going to be in November. You might also notice that my voice is not its usual energized self. I'm sick. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm sick what's the expression? Sick as a dog. I'm sitting in a hotel room in New York City. It's raining, it's cold, it's miserable, and I should be in bed. But here I am, doing the show. So if I'm not my usual energized self, forgive me, but this is about all the energy I can muster right now for the show. All right, so let's try to unpackage. Oh, by the way, One way you can help me out with the show today, given that I'm kind of out of sorts a little bit, and my mind is only working at half steam, and my voice is, we'll see when it fails completely, is call in. Call in, ask questions, make comments. Call-ins reduce the workload on the host, and right now I'm looking for a reduced workload. I promise to share... my fee. Yes, I am, as somebody in the chat mentions, I am sacrificing myself for the greater good, as all of you know. All right, I would have got a replacement host, but I didn't realize how sick I was until it was too late. Anyway, call in with any kind of questions, comments, suggestions. You want to shift topics, that's fine. Although, let's try to get through this VW mess first, because there's a lot of interesting stuff related to it. The call-in number is 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. And, call in if you have any kind of questions, any kind of issues. Any kind of suggestions, call in about anything, although let's devote the next 15 minutes to VW. All right, so let's try to untangle this mess that Volkswagen has found itself in. And the first thing to note is that in the United States, very few cars are diesel cars. So this actually, while it affects millions of cars, it's a very, very tiny proportion of the entire automobile market in the U.S. On the other hand, in Europe, There are many countries in which well over 50% of all the automobiles on the road now are diesel-fueled automobiles. If you go in France, I think it's 64% of all new cars are diesel-powered. In Germany, it's a little bit behind that, but it's over 50%. In the UK, it's over 50%. So all over Europe, there's been a massive shift to diesel. And I guess the question is why? You know, and why is it so low in the United States? Well, first you have to understand that in the U.S., gas prices generally are less than half the price that they are in Europe. And I'm sure we've got some European listeners who can attest to this. In Europe, gas taxes are massive. So while in the U.S. we have some taxes on gasoline, in Europe these taxes are massive. Basically, the taxes are there to discourage driving and discourage buying big cars. So Europe generally has smaller cars, lighter cars, and more fuel-efficient, in quotes, cars. Because gas is so expensive, people can't afford anything else. I'm sure they would love to drive the kind of cars we drive in the United States. You don't see as many, anywhere near as many SUVs and pickup trucks in Europe as you do in the United States as a consequence of this. So the way Europe has chosen to drive people into less gas-guzzling cars is by dramatically raising taxes on gasoline, and this has been true for many, many decades. This is nothing new. And indeed, diesel is cheaper than gasoline in Europe, although in spite of being cheaper, it's still quite expensive. That is, it's still more expensive than gasoline is here. So that would drive drivers to adopt diesel in Europe. In addition to that, diesel is also tends to be, modern diesel engines tend to be quite a bit more efficient in terms of using the energy, or so using they use less gallons of diesel than a regular gasoline car. An equivalent gasoline car uses gasoline. So again, another incentive. If you're pinching pennies, if cost is a concern, then diesel makes sense. But in Europe, we'll get to the United States in a minute. But then you've got an additional motivation here. And the additional motivation is that about 10, 15 years ago, Europe decided to try to significantly reduce CO2 emissions in the European Union, and to do that by reducing CO2 emissions from cars. And new generation of diesel engines came out that indeed emit far less CO2 than does a gasoline engine. So Europe went full throttle on these diesel engines, and European auto companies invested heavily in them, and they actually got to the point where, you know, you can drive. One of the problems in old diesel cars is they didn't have the performance, they didn't have the kick, there was no fun factor, power, there was no acceleration like in a regular gasoline car. Well, in recent years, European car manufacturers, the French, Peugeot, Citroën, Renault, and the Germans, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Volkswagen, Audi, have invested heavily in redesigning their diesel engines so that now you can get a diesel engine that is, performance-wise, the equivalent of a gasoline engine. It runs beautifully, and you can't tell the difference. And you emit less CO2. So this would seem to be like this fantastic new, it appeases the climate change people. It's cheaper than gasoline. It's more efficient in terms of miles per gallon. Diesel is cheaper because it's taxed less in Europe, so that's how politicians shifted the incentive structure to get people to buy diesel cars, and it succeeded. diesel cars, as I said, are everywhere in Europe. In some countries, over 60%. In other countries, in many countries, over 50% of all new cars are diesel cars. So what's the issue? Well, there's one little problem that I'm not challenging the climate change BS right now. We're not going to get into that one. Even if you believed in, I just have to say this, even if you believed in climate change, even if you thought that climate change was a real problem, dealing with, reducing CO2 emissions from automobiles is such a fraction of a fraction of the percentage of this so-called problem, right? I mean, cars emit very little emissions. So if you take carbon, if you believe carbon dioxide is a problem, I don't, but if you believe carbon dioxide is a problem, then cars and light trucks account for less than 8% of global emissions, less than 8%. American cars and light trucks account for less than 3%. So the whole idea of U.S. car manufacturers having to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to improve mileage efficiency, fuel mileage efficiency, because of so-called global warming is just stupid on its face. It's just ridiculous and stupid on its face. So put everything aside, that's ridiculous. I mean, what emits most of this, CO2 is the production of electricity and heavy industry. And, of course, if we shifted to electric cars, all that would mean is we'd need to produce more electricity. But, that's for another day. We're talking about diesel. Okay, so this is the inconvenient truth about diesel cars. And this is what the whole VW scandal about its U.S. cars reveals. While diesel cars emit less CO2, they are far, far worse in emitting other pollutants. So these cars pollute nitrogen oxides. Now, nitrogen oxide are substantial pollutants, and they create them together with particulate matter, little particles, right? That the diesel engines also pollute much, much more than do normal engines, gasoline engines. These are the kind of pollutants that create smog. So smog is created because of these pollutants. So the United States has regulated these pollutants far, far more heavily than the Europeans have, because in the U.S. we're much more concerned about smog, particularly in places like L.A., which one could argue, I'm not going to, but I wouldn't argue, but one could argue, it is a real concern for people. Supposedly, based on what I've read, nitrogen oxide and these particulates that the diesel engines emit are far more are directly associated with harmful effects on human beings' health. So there's a direct link versus CO2 emission, which is speculation about global warming one day. These things are really supposedly, have some unspecified level of harm to human health right now. See, in the United States, we have regulated these the nitrogen oxides and these particles in the air much more heavily than we have regulated CO2, because I think we have bought in less, to a large extent, far less than the Europeans into this global warming stuff, right? So if you look at the emission standards that the United States has on nitrogen oxide, it's 0.07 grams per mile. In Western Europe, the limit is 0.29 grams per mile, four times more. So our standards four times more rigid than they are in Europe. And that's the incentive to cheat, right? So Volkswagen makes millions and millions and millions of cars for the European market, and they're fine for Europe. And they have high performance, and they do great, and people love driving them, and they're really good cars and nice cars and so on. And but they can't use those same cars in the United States because they're not clean enough. They don't abide by the American regulatory standard of 0.09 grams per mile. And in order to get it down to 0.07 grams per mile, in order to get down to there, they would probably have to take a significant hit on performance. A significant hit on performance. These cars are finely calibrated because diesel is not a performance fuel typically. It's very complex. It's very sophisticated to get the car to have high performance and be clean and not emit CO2 and have high gas mileage. So you've got all these requirements, CO2 emission, fuel mileage, pollutants, and then performance. And they've somehow managed to pull that off, potentially in Europe. We still don't know all the details. Who knows? But in the United States, they couldn't technically pull it off. So what did they do? They cheated. They basically created a software. They put into the software a false reading. So everything now is electronic. When you do emission tests, when you do all these tests, they basically cheated on the emission standards. They basically put in the software a false reading so that whoever tests this would get a false reading. And that's how they could bring these Volkswagen, it turns out, some Audi cars into the United States that were diesel. Now, why don't Americans drive diesel cars? Americans don't drive diesel generally because gasoline is so damn cheap. It just doesn't make any sense to buy a diesel car. Gasoline is cheap. Generally, cars on gasoline perform better. And, so we have tended to be gasoline consumers and gasoline car buyers. And that's not going to change, right? Very tiny. But those, I love it because all those Greens who wanted to be socially responsible and wanted to buy a car that wasn't polluting, wasn't creating CO2, but who maybe couldn't afford to buy the subsidized electric cars, bought diesel cars. And it turns out that they've been polluting more than any other car out there. It turns out that, they have been maybe not adding to so-called global warming, but they've been adding to the smog all over U.S. cities. By the way, smog has become a huge, huge problem in Europe since it shifted to diesel. Paris, London, and other European cities that used to be smog-free today have real problems with smog. So they're paying the consequences of shifting to, if you want to be CO2, if you want to have less CO2, you're going to have more of other pollutants. The fact is that human life requires that there be some waste. There's going to be some waste from human activities. And the choice ultimately is between life and waste. I take life. To hell with a little bit of smog, some pollution, even global warming, so it gets warm a little bit. Right now, here in New York City, we could use a little bit of warmth. So, diesel vehicles are more expensive. This is the other aspect of it, and then we'll take a break. Diesel cars are more expensive because they're much more complicated to build in order to be both fuel efficient and low CO2 emissions and all these other things. So they're more expensive. And there's just no way to in the United States to build them in a way that we are going to buy them, because it just doesn't make sense to, if you, somebody did a calculation, if you pay the extra and then diesel is a little cheaper and they have higher gas mileage, but it still takes you at least 4 years to pay off, because gasoline is so cheap, at least 4 years to pay off your diesel engines. So Americans are not doing it. So, okay, that's kind of the backstory. We'll get back and we'll talk a little bit more about this right after this break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
So we're talking about the VW scandal and how, at its core, this is a scandal about politicians meddling in the auto industry, meddling in business that is not theirs. Let auto companies build the cars that we want to buy. Let auto companies innovate. And my guess is that if in the United States we got rid of fuel efficiency standards and we got rid of all these stupid environmentalist regulations, if Europe did the same, we would actually get better, cheaper, more fuel efficient, safer less polluting automobiles. Because what government mandates do is they force companies to adopt particular types of standards, particular type of fuels, particular type of engines. And they force companies to have trade-offs between one pollutant and a different pollutant. And they restrict innovation. This is what force does. This is what regulations do. Regulations always, by focusing on just one issue and usually dictating solutions from above, they stifle innovation. They stifle new ideas. They stifle, you know, the ingenuity of the engineers at these auto companies. Who knows? If they just had a general problem of how do we make cars that people really want to buy, given that people, all of us, care that we're not, you know, that we're not spewing garbage into the air that makes people sick. Nobody wants to drive a car that's actually going to make people sick or going to make it unpleasant to be around. If we just allowed these auto companies to engage in supply and demand, to engage in supplying the kind of products we customers of these auto companies demand, we would get much cleaner, much better, much higher performance automobiles than we do today. Europe, for example, has traded off one type of so-called pollutant, so-called, I emphasize, CO2, under the guise that it causes global warming, with other pollutants, these particles, this nitrogen oxide, which is causing massive pollution in their cities, smog and other forms of pollution. And actually, these other forms of pollutants are known to hurt the health of human beings. They've traded off a fantasy, a speculation, models that don't work on global climate change for something we know, something that there's no question about, the health hazards of these other pollutants. But this is typical of government regulations and government mandates, that they cause these kind of trade-offs, and they force people into making the trade-offs in a non-rational way. Actually, they incentivize you into taking the less best choice, the worst choice among many choices available. And of course, politicians know this. And one of the interesting things about what's going on in Europe right now, is that politicians know that these diesel engines are causing this pollution, and they know that they have manipulated the market into bringing about this diesel, and they don't care. They don't care because their auto companies lobby heavily for these regulations because they have a comparative advantage. Japanese companies are very good at hybrids. European companies are very good at diesel. And European governments are helping their own industry, their industries, their local industries. You know, this is mercantilism, this is protectionism, in order to maintain that market. So the French government is not going to come out against diesel when it's three big auto companies. That's what they specialize in. And that's what's selling right now. Volkswagen, for example, is partially owned by the German state of Lower Saxony. So it's partially government-owned. And it's largely controlled by this big German union called IG Metall, which is heavily involved in German politics, you know, left and right. So I wouldn't be surprised if these politicians knew that Volkswagen and maybe other companies are evading some of these mandates in the U.S. and maybe in other countries. I think now they're probably evading them in Australia and some other countries as well. They don't care. So politicians are willing to accept huge costs, increased cost of automobiles, increased cost of fuel, in order to present themselves as you know, savers of the world from climate change. At the same time, they are causing other pollution that is worse for human beings. And they are providing incentives for businessmen to cheat. And they're looking to the other side. They're looking away when these businessmen actually do cheat for nationalistic reasons. So it's just a mess, you know, all throughout. Just a complete and utter mess and a complete and utter disaster. Yeah. So, you know, that's the VW scandal. Now, you know, is this an example of fraud? Sure. I mean, to the extent that they are advertising these cars as having specific emission standards and they don't, this is fraud. But this is fraud as incentivized by irrational regulations. So this is not something I would get particularly angry about the business, you know, as a consequence of this. What I would question is the whole regulatory framework that brings about irrational decisions by consumers and irrational decisions by manufacturers, and that creates these opportunities for cronyism, because you bet that auto companies are going to lobby, they're going to lobby heavily to have whatever standard is adopted be the standard that they have a competitive advantage in. So what is going on, what the scandal is revealing, is the extent to which government regulation is manipulating the auto business, to the extent to which the auto industry and government are intertwined. This is certainly true in Europe, but it's also incredibly true in the United States. Well, I mean, everybody remembers the bailouts. But, you know, Chrysler, GM, Ford, all heavily lobby government to try to generate, you know, the best, to generate regulations that benefit them and disfavor the competition, the Japanese cars, the European cars. So this is what happened when government starts intervening in markets. It starts creating distortion upon distortion upon distortion. And yes, some of these companies are going to try to cheat, you know, to get around the distortions created by government. All right, if you want to talk about this or other stuff, the number is 347-324-3075. 347-324-3075. And when you call in, you have to, like, press 1 so that I can see that you've called in and you want to ask a question, that you're not just calling in to listen to the show. So you have to press 1 so that I can see that you're interested in asking something. So call in. It'll help me and my throat and my cold if you guys do some of the talking and it's not just me chatting constantly. So 347-324-3075. All right, so I think that's all I really had to say about the diesel and the cars. It's interesting. I think what's interesting is the extent to which politicians are linked to this, the extent to which people are, you know, to the extent that in Europe, this is probably a bigger crisis and a bigger deal than it is in the United States. It's an interesting story. I'm going to keep following it. If there are any new kind of new things to point out, we will. But again, you know, this is what happens. You know, people talk about unintended consequences. I don't know if they're intended or not. It doesn't matter. The consequences of regulation are always, even if you can't see it initially, even if it takes a long time to see it, even if it's not obvious, the consequences of the government getting involved in business are always negative, always bad. You want to, So if one problem is through regulation, you create 55 other ones. And the VW scandal is an example of that, of European cities being polluted, of people buying stupid cars, which they shouldn't be buying, costlier cars, because diesel cars are more expensive, because it's much more difficult to rig them in a way as to have the kind of performance that a gasoline car has, and so on. Now, this issue raised the issue of climate change. And the issue of climate change raised an interesting issue that I've been reading about, that I find one of the scariest issues out there, and this is the issue of free speech. And I just want to cover this quickly in the next 5 minutes before we take a break. I don't know if you've been following this, but there's been a call by some scientists and at least one senator, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, to use federal RICO powers to investigate climate change so-called skeptics. So people who might deny the science behind the whole global warming, climate change hysteria. White House a few months ago wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post where he said this should be investigated, that the government should investigate groups that claim the global warming is not happening. They should investigate their connections to industry. Now, RICO gives government huge powers. And, you know, I don't know how much you know about RICO, but RICO was a law that was passed in 1970 to try to go after gangsters, mobsters, organized crime. And it gives, for example, the ability to prosecutors to seize assets before anybody's found guilty. Because with organized crime, they would prosecute, and by the time they got a guilty verdict, the assets were gone. I mean, the criminals had made them disappear, had shielded them, had moved them elsewhere. So RICO gives the government vast powers. I suspect that even in cases of organized crime, these powers are unconstitutional, but I'm not an expert on this. I suspect that RICO goes way above and beyond what is reasonable. Now, since RICO was used in organized crime in the 70s, it's been used on lots of other industries, financial industry. Giuliani, one of the things I hate most about Mayor Giuliani is that he used RICO on Wall Street, was the first one to use it, and since it's been used extensively, and he did horrific things to Wall Street financiers when he was district attorney for the Southern District of New York. Anyway, but relevant to using RICO on so-called climate change deniers, RICO was used against the tobacco industry. And there was a period in which it was threatened to be used about anybody who might claim that the science about tobacco and its harmful effects was wrong. Now, it doesn't matter what the truth is here. The point is this. Freedom of speech is not just for truth. It's not just about what's right. Freedom of speech is absolute. You have a right to speak even if scientists disagree with you, even if most scientists disagree with you, even if it turned out all scientists disagreed with you. Freedom of speech in that sense is absolute. We've talked about this many times on the show. But what Sheldon Whitehouse and what 20 scientists who wrote a letter to President Obama are claiming is that there's a conspiracy to deny a absolute, unquestioned scientific truth, i.e. climate change, and that the government should investigate. It should investigate all companies, think tanks, and individuals engaged in so-called climate change denial and prosecute them under RICO for conspiracy, and that the reason free speech doesn't hold here is because the claims of the climate change deniers are untrue. And they claim that freedom of speech only applies to true statements, which is just bizarre, right? And who gets to decide what true is and what isn't true? Which scientists? What percentage of them? Most great breakthroughs in science were considered by mainstream scientists to be untrue. And it took a while to be convinced. Are we going to silence anybody who comes up with something new, something different? That's the goal. The goal is to silence people. And they are so far successful. Unsuccessful, but they are trying. And this is really scary. And the fact that anybody would be supportive of this, the fact that this didn't create a huge outcry in the press and everywhere else. I mean, this would basically say that, you know, you can't advocate anymore. You can't hold a position and advocate for a position that was unpopular or that some influential group believed was wrong. They would then come after you. Freedom of speech doesn't apply, they would claim. So this is, again, something to watch. I don't think anything's going to happen. I think this is even too radical for this administration to actually go after scientists and industry and groups that reject the so-called science of climate change. But this is worth watching because it started out with an op-ed by a senator. Now we've got a bunch of scientists and people kind of supporting these scientists in the press and elsewhere. And this is one more piece, one more action, driven by this general erosion of understanding of what free speech is. Free speech doesn't apply, they claim, to offensive speech. Free speech doesn't apply to what they claim is incorrect speech. They want to silence us. And this is becoming a greater and greater problem and something to watch because nothing's more important, nothing's more crucial to our survival than the existence of free speech and our ability to advocate against the status quo, against the bad ideas that are destroying this country, and to replace them with good ideas, with wonderful ideas. Now, okay, so we're gonna shift here a little bit. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to be talking to the CEO of Strive. This is a student organization inspired by objectivism, who wants to help bring about a positive change to the world and has taken action on American campuses to bring the ideas of reason and individualism and capitalism to students all over the country. And we're going to talk about an exciting upcoming conference in November that Strive is putting together. So when we get back after this commercial, we're going to talk to the CEO of Strive. Stay tuned.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind? A hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades? The need to prove superiority? Or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Rourke, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Rourke, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AynRand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Hi, Aaron.
Margaret, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, okay. So, hi, Margaret. Welcome to the Aaron Brooks Show. And I'm sure our listeners are intrigued by this new organization called Strive. I don't think many of them have heard about it. Where did this come from, and who is this, and what's the mission? What are the goals?
Okay, well, Strive stands for Students for Reason, Individualism, Value Pursuit, and Enterprise. And we've grown out of a longstanding student magazine called The Undercurrent. The Undercurrent was founded back in 2005 by a group of objectivist students who had campus clubs across the nation, and they came together to create a campus publication that would act as a loose umbrella joining their various clubs. Since then, we've decided that we need an organization that's specifically dedicated to students' needs on campus, and that's how Strive was born.
And why the change to Strive versus the Undercurrent?
Well, we no longer think that we're the Undercurrent for to start with, but slightly more seriously, the former approach to campus clubs was to think about sort of very deep study of objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy, and we realized that that's quite a high bar to expect from students, especially freshmen who've just gotten on campus and may not have been exposed to Rand's ideas in depth yet. So we thought about, well, what's essential about Rand's ideas that's applicable and accessible to students who are just starting out on their intellectual careers? And we thought that that's the aspects of first-handedness, of enterprise, of initiative. There are a lot of students who have those qualities and who want to make something of their lives, and we believe that those characteristics predispose them to being open to Rand's ideas, that people who are prime movers in some sense hold Rand's values to some degree and are the most open to having those values identified for them and brought to the fore. And so we want to reach out on that basis, and we think we can get a really broad base of interest that way.
Great. So what kind of activities are you expecting your clubs to be engaged in the year to come or the years to come?
Well, there's both what the clubs do, and there's a leadership progression and leadership development that we hope the clubs will foster. So if we start with what the clubs are actually going to do on campus, on the one hand, there is an outreach component, ways of engaging students on campus. And we're doing that through a series of workshops, which we call the It's Your Life, Own It workshops, workshops that are designed to get students thinking about how they can take responsibility for their own lives. For example, the workshop which we've just launched in September on three campuses so far is called Set a Purpose for Your College Career and Act on It. We've realized that setting a purpose, just writing a mission statement, can often help students improve their results. That's based on Ed Locke's research, who is an objectivist professor and thinker on motivation. And Rand also talked about the importance of purpose as organizing, having an organizing and hierarchical aspect to your life. Setting a purpose allows you to organize and prioritize the things that you want to do and be more effective in achieving them. So we thought that, you know, the idea of purpose is very core to objectivism, and it's also something that students are vitally interested in as they're starting their college careers. Like, why am I here? You know, what do I want to achieve? So by putting on a workshop that get students talking about purpose and thinking about the purpose they want to set for themselves, we're both hitting a core idea of objectivism, and we're reaching an important question for students as they start their college careers.
And how many clubs are now engaged in these seminars? How many seminars like this do you expect to do in the next 12 months or so?
We've been incubating this. So you can think of us as an intellectual startup, if you will. For the past 4 months, we've handpicked six exceptional student leaders with whom we've been creating these new materials, these new workshops. We've been meeting once a month and spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, what's important, what should be done, and the students have actually been designing the workshops for their peers. We're in piloting mode, and we started launching this programming on three campuses. One is at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Another one is University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And the third one is American University in Washington, D.C.
Okay, so if students listening to this want to get involved, what's the best way to get involved? And then maybe we can talk about the conference that's coming up in November.
Well, actually, signing up for the conference is the best way that they can get involved at this point.
So let's jump in and talk about the conference.
Fantastic. So Strive not only operates locally on each campus, but we have a number of national initiatives where the students work together, both to propagate the ideas, but also to learn leadership and organization skills. So one of our initiatives is the Fall Student Conference, which is being organized in partnership with you guys at ARI. So thank you for that. And the Fall Conference is on the morality of value creation and trade. It's going to be held in Atlanta, Georgia, from November 6th to November 8th. And it will feature a number of successful business leaders. So folks that, you know, who are household names, who you've heard of, who've achieved a great deal of success and who are openly inspired by the ideas of Ayn Rand and represent how these ideas can lead to success in the professional sphere. So we want to showcase that and celebrate that. On the other hand, the Ayn Rand Institute will be providing a number of thinkers who can explain and make vivid the ideas that underlie the morality of value creation and trade. So together we'll have the sort of practical implementation and the philosophical basis, and a number of active professionals, sort of mid-career folks who are living their values and who can make concrete to students across a wide variety of fields, from medicine to law to education, you know, what it's like to engage in that particular career and pursue their values in that area. So it's the objective is to create a rapport between those professionals and the students.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the conference. It's as Margaret said, it's on November 6th to 8th in Atlanta, Georgia, and I encourage anybody listening, any of the students listening, to sign up for it. We'll talk about how you sign up for it in a minute. I think I'm doing the opening talk at the conference, and I know a number of ARI intellectuals are going to be speaking at the conference. But I'm particularly excited to hear some of the business leaders and some of the objectivists with a lot of work experience, entrepreneurial experience, startup experience. I mean, this is going to be quite an experience for young students to be surrounded by so many, you know, quality people and so many successful people, and who really project this positive vision of what objectivism can make possible. So the conference is open to students. That's right. It's just students. Not everybody could attend. Is that right?
Well, certainly students are favored in as much as they can receive a scholarship that will cover their cost of attendance. So students, listen up. This is free for you. If you check it out at striveclubs.org/conference2015, you can apply for a scholarship and attend for free. However, if you're an early career professional, maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years in the workforce, you're recently a student and you're interested in attending, you may do so because you'd get benefit from the networking opportunities as well, but you do have to pay your own way, and the assumption is, since you're working, that it's something that's accessible to you. So the primary focus is on students, and students are getting sponsored to attend.
So the non-students can register on the same URL. There's a place there where they can register and pay.
Absolutely, they can pick the professional or mentor option, and we'll get in touch to see if you have the seniority and gravitas to kind of act as a mentor, or if you're just a participant in the conference and can benefit from the event.
Okay, I didn't even realize that anybody could come. That's great. But if you're students, you get a full scholarship. The scholarship includes travel expenses. For many students?
Yes. So the mechanism is as follows. We ask everybody to pay a $50 registration fee. That's just a sign of commitment. And then after the conference is done and after you've participated in the conference, you get the $50 back. You also get your hotel stay covered, and you get a contribution towards your flight, which is based on the flight distance. I think if you're on the East Coast, you get $300 towards your flight and $500 if you're on the West Coast, which in most cases should cover all of your travel expenses.
So we're really planning this to be a conference, a national conference. It's in Atlanta, but we're hoping people come in from California, from New York, from the Midwest, from all over the country, and make this kind of the premier student event of the year for anybody really interested in objectivism and in success and in value creation.
Absolutely, and it's going to be an important kickoff for 2016 clubs program. So the material that we've incubated with our student leaders for the past 3 months, we'll be seeking the next 10 leaders that will be handpicked out of the student participants. And early in January, we'll be holding a training session for them, familiarizing them with the Strive Club materials, and then they'll be free to run their own clubs on their own campuses. So it's a chance for exceptional students to show us how good they are and get selected as the next Strive Club leaders across the nation.
Yeah, and as a student, you don't have to be a committed objectivist to attend. You can be just interested in Ayn Rand or interested in the ideas. We're setting up a kind of an ideological filter. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the reasons we called the club Strive is we thought that, reason, individualism, value pursuit, enterprise, those are some key characteristics that bring us all together, but there's no requirement that you be a committed objectivist or dedicated to the ideas of Ayn Rand. I think as long as you have that sort of prime mover desire to do something with your life, and you're interested in learning about the ideas and interested in engaging in discussion, you're absolutely welcome at the conference. I think it'll be a great dialogue and great learning experience for everyone.
Yeah, so if you're a student listening to the show, this is a fantastic opportunity for you. You get to meet a lot of successful people. You get to meet some of the intellectuals behind the objectivist movement, a lot of the successful businessmen who've been inspired by Ayn Rand, and you get to meet lots and lots of other students interested in similar things to what you're interested in, and it's free. You just need to apply, and it says so. Margaret, give us the URL again. I think they can also find information about this if you go to the Ayn Rand Institute website, but I think it's easier if you go to the Strive website directly, which is?
Striveclubs.org/conference. So that's www.striveclubs.org/conference. And all the information is there about the conference and how to register. So, yeah, we're very excited to have this opportunity to offer to students and excited to meet everyone who comes.
Yeah, and the Ayn Rand Institute is very excited about working with Strive on this and on other projects. We're very, very excited to start really trying to form a student movement, a significant, substantive student movement that can really have an impact out there on the lives of the kids and on the culture on the campuses. So thank you, Margaret, for invigorating the efforts of the Undercurrent and refocusing kind of the objective student movement or the objective inspired student movement.
Well, thanks so much, Yaron, for your time today.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks. That's okay. That's Strive. Go to strive.org for more information about what we just heard about the conference. I'll be there, as I told you, I'll be there on Friday. I'll be giving the opening talk for the conference, and I'd love to see as many of you as possible. I love meeting listeners to the show who I haven't met before. It's always inspiring for me. And we are going to take another quick break, and after that, we'll be right back to talk about, I don't know, maybe we'll talk about Syria.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
All right, you're listening to the Yaron Brooks Show, and I apologize again for I'm under the weather, and My brain is only half functioning. My voice is only half functioning. But hopefully we can still create an entertaining show for all of you of some value. Call in. You can call in and talk about any issues you choose, 347-324-3075. Remember, I think it's to press 1 so that you so I know that you're calling in order to actually ask a question. That's 347-324-3075. You're listening to the Yaron Brooks Show, and let's see, we have a caller. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Dave from Portland, Oregon. Am I on the radio?
You are, Dave. How's it going?
Oh, great, great. Fascinating show today. Thank you so much, and going the extra mile for us today. I wonder if I could ask you a question about the Cuban embargo, and maybe in comparison to our trade policy with China.
Sure.
And what you think about that, and by what standard, I guess.
Well, I think I've talked about this on a show in the past, but I would say a rational foreign policy would divide the world into basically three categories. One category would be, you know, countries that are basically free and basically friendly to the United States. You know, there's a lot of issues about how you define basically free, but basically free, basically friendly, not a threat, and to treat their citizens, you know, reasonably well, given the world we live in. And I would say that countries like that, we should both be trading with, and we should have diplomatic relationships. We should have an embassy. Our president should visit their national leaders. Their national leaders should visit us. I mean, in a sense, these are countries that we're sanctioning. They were saying, this country's a okay country. It's a good country. So think about today, you would include in countries like that, you would include Western Europe, you'd include Israel, you'd include parts of Asia, certainly Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, places like that. Then I would say there's a second category, and this is a category of countries that are basically unfree, that treat their citizens poorly in the sense of individual rights, but that are not a threat to the United States. That is, these countries are not enemies of the U.S. They don't have a military stance that is threatening towards the United States. They don't have a foreign policy that is threatening to the United States. And here I would include a country like Cuba. Cuba is clearly a bad country and horrible treatment of its own people. But it's not a threat to the U.S. It was a threat in the early 60s because it was part of the Soviet bloc, and it was certainly then they were thinking about putting on missiles from the Soviet Union in Cuba, so that was threatening. So certainly in those days it was, and I think as long as the Soviet Union existed, Cuba was a threat. And we'll get to what happens when you're a threat. But if you're not a threat, but you're a bad country, then I think the government should not recognize you. No embassy, no diplomatic relations, no visiting, you know, presidents and stuff like that. But at the same time, I think you should be allowed to trade with that country. That is, trading with that country does not help that country threaten you. So I think it should be a choice. Some people might choose not to trade with the country because of how it treats its own people. Other people might say, you know, it's still in my interest in some way, but the government has no role to play here. The government, remember, is here to protect our individual rights. And if this country, Cuba, let's say, is not threatening our individual rights, then the U.S. government has no role to play in restricting my relationship with this country. I would not trade, let's say, with Cuba, but others might choose to trade. The third category is countries that are a threat to the United States. These almost always will be unfree countries that are also a threat to the United States. Iran would be an example of that. North Korea would be an example of that. And there are not that many. I mean, I believe Saudi Arabia is an example of that. There are not that many countries like this. But there are countries out there that literally really do threaten the U.S. I mean, Russia might or might not be. I mean, you'd have to make that evaluation. That's what That's why foreign policy is hard, because you'd have to make those kind of evaluations. And a country like that, that is a threat to the United States, should be embargoed. You should not be allowed to trade with them. And, of course, you should not have diplomatic relations with them. So those are the three categories. So in my view, Obama's gone too far with Cuba. I think he was right to do away with the embargo. Indeed, I don't think he's gone far enough there. I think they should eliminate all restrictions on travel and on commercial interaction. But I don't think we should have opened an embassy, and I certainly don't think the Secretary of State should be visiting Cuba, and I don't think the Cubans should be invited to visit Cuban heads of state should be invited to visit the United States. All right. Does that answer your question?
Very much so. Thank you very much.
Sure. My pleasure. Anytime. Thanks for calling the Iran Book Show. We have another call. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hey, Aaron, this is Andrew calling from Africa. I hope everybody's doing well.
Hey, Andrew, I can tell that South African accent. Can you speak up? Because you're coming across very softly.
Hang on a second. I'm just going to change my volume. Is that a little bit better?
Yeah, that's a little bit better. So what's on your mind in South Africa?
Oh, just that it's, it's kind of like we're stuck between two different extremes. I mean, I don't understand enough about objectivism to make a probably very valid argument, but, you know, on the one hand, I don't like the socialism thing because it is ridiculous. It's a big stick with which certain special interests can hit everybody else over the head with. But at the same time, the logical outcome for me on a lot of these things are like, we could just say, well, you know, it's okay for Wall Street and the Federal Reserve and those guys to do what they do to everybody as well, you know, because ultimately that's what's best for bankers, you know. And
yeah, but so let's not confuse, Andrew, capitalism with cronyism. What we have today in places like the United States is cronyism. There's no capitalism here. And what we have is a Federal Reserve that wouldn't exist in an objectivist society. It wouldn't exist under capitalism. There is no Federal Reserve under capitalism. And banks under capitalism would have to survive by their own merit. That is, the banks would either do good business and create real value, or they would go under. Nobody would bail them out under a truly capitalist government. What we have today is a mixed economy with elements of freedom, elements that are shrinking all the time,
right,
and a lot of fascist socialist state intervention, which is what the Federal Reserve and the bailouts are. So I guess I'm not sure why you're not saying, well, what I'm for is capitalism.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult because at its core, what I understand what you're saying. But I think capitalism as a concept in so many people's minds has become that crony capitalism in their minds, if you know what I mean. And then they fall back on the socialism thing, which is the other side of that coin, which is really sad. So I suppose the big question is, how do we get people out of this, like, kind of this constant diet, like, kind of double bind?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think so many people have convinced themselves that capitalism equals cronyism. And one of our jobs as advocates for change, as revolutionaries, as people with different ideas, is to go out there and re-educate them. I mean, we have no choice, and that is to reclaim what capitalism is really about, which is freedom. We're the advocates for freedom. We're the advocates for non-cronyism, non-socialism, non-government intervention in the economy, non-force. I mean, we are for freedom, freedom of action, free of coercion, free of force. And that's what we really are. And I don't think we should buy into the false dichotomy that kind of our enemies have created. You know, it's either you're a socialist or you're a crony. No, you don't have to be a socialist or a crony. You can be a true advocate for real freedom and liberty and individual rights and a life free of coercion. That's what capitalism should mean. Maybe we need a new word for it, but I don't think it's the word that matters. I think it's the intention.
Yeah.
So we need a fight. There are no shortcuts in life. This is just about educating, arguing, convincing, changing people's minds.
Yeah, I think it's also just the systems that we use because, I've been looking at a lot of stuff by Robert Steele, and I want to try and find out more about open source intelligence. Because really, we're dealing with a monetary system and various other systems around us that are either stuck in that one paradigm or the other. They're either feeding the certain special interests through socialism or through crony capitalism, and everybody keeps kind of bouncing between the two as opposed to creating their own system. But it's almost like, you know, Ayn Rand's concepts of, you know, that's the foundation that we can take to kind of use as a springboard. But there seems to be not a lot of people focusing on that open source intelligence in terms of, like, you know, I'd love for people to start phoning in and saying, well, this is what we're doing in our area this week. We've created our own alternative monetary system, and we're utilizing the blockchain on the Bitcoin network to be able to trade real assets. And we're no longer using U.S. dollars. and we're helping the community next to us. You know?
But the fact is, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because the guys who are in charge of the U.S. dollars have big guns and big influence.
Yeah.
And as soon as the blockchain or Bitcoin gains any kind of steam, they're going to shut it down. They can at least confiscate the physical assets.
I agree.
And
at the same time, you've got to have...
Until we change the political process, until we change their ability to do that, I don't think you can establish freedom in small localities or over the internet. I don't think it's meaningful to talk about freedom, you know, separate from the nation state as it exists today. We have to take over the nation state, and the only way to do that is through education and changing people's minds. Unfortunately, I really don't think there's shortcuts, and I don't think blockchain and Bitcoin, I mean, they might help, they might accelerate things, but not in fast enough and not in dramatic enough fashion. And I know there are a bunch of people out there who disagree about this, but that's my take, and maybe I don't know enough about the technology.
Well, look, I mean, I just wanted to use that as one example of how I'd love to hear people calling in about that kind of stuff. And I mean, look, we could go into that, but the thing is, there's another question, and that's DARPA, something like DARPA. I mean, you made a very good point there, Aaron. A lot of people, they don't take into account that, yes, you can go off the grid. Yes, you can create your own little sustainable community or whatever and not have to pay for water and lighting and you have your own solar panels. But ultimately, you know, if DARPA has technology where they can fly a drone over your space and just bomb you because you're not living in the megacity, then that's a huge problem. It's like until people start realizing, okay, you've also got to create your own drones.
Sure.
And you've also got to create your
absolutely.
Own...
Absolutely, and that's why it's unrealistic to go ahead and go create your own community separate because these guys have big guns. There's no question about that. Great, Andrew, I'm running out of time here, and I've got one more caller.
All right.
Thanks for
John.
Calling in. Good luck down there in South Africa. Talk to you soon. And we got another caller. Hi, you're on the Yvonne Brooks Show. Make it quick because we don't have a lot of time.
Yes, Dr. Yaron Brook.
Yes.
Dr. Brook?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Skyler Saunders from Delaware. I was wondering what your opinion was of taunting.
What do you mean by taunting?
Taunting, T-O-N-T-I-N-E, taunting. They're like
these are these insurance policies, annuities?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's too complicated to get into in the few minutes that I
have.
So we'll leave it for another show. But let me just say that generally, I have nothing against it. As long as it's a voluntary contract that everybody is aware and there's no deception and there's no fraud going into it, then there's nothing immoral, there's nothing fraudulent about the essence. It's a type of insurance. So I don't see a huge issue here. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about it another time when we can get into more of the details of it. All right?
Absolutely. I know you're under the weather. I hope you feel better, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks.
Absolutely. You take care.
Thank you. All right. So you're listening to Yaron Brooks Show. We are coming up on our last break, which will be followed by my segment on this week's positive value. And so we didn't get to Syria. We didn't get to talk about it. I've got a lot to say about it, so we'll have to keep that on have to keep that for next week's show, but I'm glad we got to some callers and got to some of the issues that are on the top of your mind, and you're listening to Yaron Brooks Show. We'll be right back with the positive value of the week.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, this is the On Book Show, and we always dedicate the last 10 minutes of the show to some positive values and to something positive, particularly in the arts. And that's what I want to do today. And last time we started a discussion about opera, and I hope you'll forgive me, but we're gonna do a little bit more of that. Last night I went to see a production of Othello at the Metropolitan Opera Company here in New York City. I'm as you know, I'm in New York for this week. I leave tomorrow, but I've been here all week. And it was fabulous. I mean, and this is the thing I wanted to emphasize. Othello the opera is this merger, the combination of two of the greatest artistic geniuses in human history, Shakespeare and Verdi. My favorite opera composer and the greatest playwright in history. And it's unbelievably powerful, emotionally draining, in parts just beautiful and gorgeous, in other parts just horrific and horrible. And this is the thing about Othello. It's an evil, evil story. It basically is a story about the efficacy and success of evil. It's about the destruction of the good. It is so horrific. The story is so, wow, is so bad from a philosophical perspective. If you're an objectivist, this is nihilism at its worst. The hero, if you will, the character that moves the action in Othello is Iago. And Iago is one of the most evil villains of all time. He's motivated purely by hatred. There's no upside. There's nothing to be gained. This is just about evil. We're talking about Othello. So, you know, you have to have the ability to watch this on stage and to buy into the premise. And in my case, still enjoy it. Enjoy the drama. Enjoy the emotion. Enjoy the fantastic music. The amazing dialogue, the portrayal, the spectacular portrayal of these characteristics, both good and evil, in Othello and in Iago, and the destruction of Othello. I've seen Othello on stage as a play, and again, very powerful. And I enjoy it. It is truly, you know, I find it inspiring. Now, I know a lot of you are like, what? How can you enjoy artwork that depicts values that are evil? So I want to refer you to two lectures by Lena Peikoff. The first is available on campus.einrand.org. That's campus.einrand.org. And that's 8 great plays. This is one of my favorite all-time objectivist lecture courses. Actually, I think if you ask Leonard Peikoff, he would say this is his favorite course that he's ever done. It's where he takes 8 great plays and analyzes them. And one of those plays is Othello. And I highly, highly recommend you listen to his analysis of Othello, both its vices, its evil philosophy, but also its virtues. What makes this possibly the greatest play ever written? And what makes Shakespeare possibly the greatest playwright ever written, in spite of the fact that philosophically he is maybe the worst? That is, what? How do you make that separation? And how can you enjoy a play that has an evil idea at its core? Go listen to 8 Great Plays. Go watch it. It's on. It's free on campus.einrad.org. This used to cost hundreds of dollars. People paid hundreds of dollars to listen to this. I think it's fabulous. Not just Othello. You should listen to all of them. You should read the plays. You'll love it. I mean, wow. There's some plays there you've probably never read. There's a lot of stuff there you've probably never experienced. It's fantastic. So read. Go to campus.einrand.org. Listen to 8 great plays. The other lecture I want to refer you to is an important one for your ability to enjoy this kind of art. And it's a lecture that Leonard Peikoff gave called The Survival Value of Great Art. Now, you can get this for, I think it's 99 cents or $2.99 or $3.99, something pretty cheap where you can download it. It is on the e-store, on the Ayn Rand Institute e-store. So just look it up on Google, Ayn Rand Institute e-store. And it's called The Survival Value of Great Art. Again, one of my favorite Leonard Peikoff talks. And there he talks about the epistemological and just life-affirming value of great art that might be horrific philosophically. So I would recommend going to listen to this course. I think it would expand your horizon quite a bit because so much of the artwork today is philosophically evil and bad. And yet, there's value in it. There's value to you as a rational being in experiencing it in spite of its philosophy. And examples there are Tolstoy, but even a better example of that is Dostoevsky, which has a horrible sense of life, but is great romantic art. And Ayn Rand enjoyed Dostoevsky. Leonard Peikoff enjoyed Tolstoy. So I recommend those two lectures, courses by Dr. Peikoff. I recommend if you're in New York, go see the opera Othello. It's heart-wrenching. It's evil at its most evil, and yet it's immensely enjoyable. So I'll leave you with that, with Othello, with opera, with great art, even when it has bad philosophy. Talk to you next week. This is your Ron Brooks Show, signing off. Have a great rest of your weekend.